surprised me there, Shirley. My goodness.
A little arpeggio there.
Yeah, it was. So he was here too, wasn't he?
Yeah. I ate some of that once.
Did you really?
Oh, what birthday is it?
I'm 27, 28 years old.
You don't look a year old.
I know, right. I'm 63 today, and I want you to know that the staff has no compassion on me. I was given this card by my right-hand man, that is, one who used to have that position in school. The Reverend Dr. Charlie Dyer sends me this picture of this old coot. It says, as you get older, you gain knowledge, tolerance, and serenity, then your teeth fall out. Oh, Charlie. My secretary last year gave me an interesting card. It says, when they give you your birthday cake, don't blow out all the candles at once or it'll set off the smoke alarm. Oh, my. Well, one of the things about moving to Texas was the change of culture from California to redneck world of Texas. And so I rather regularly have my devotions with Jeff Foxworthy as I read over some of the things that mark out a redneck lifestyle. Some of them are terrific. You might be a redneck if when your front porch falls down, you kill more than 9 dogs. If you could use your wife's earrings as a fishing lure, you are a redneck. There are some fishermen. No, it's just a joke. If you have a tire swing somewhere in your living room, you might be a redneck. If your idea of a fun night is shooting rats at the dump, you might be a redneck. If your mama shops for groceries barefooted, you are a redneck. I tried to picture that just this morning. If your kids take a siphoning hose to school for show and tell, then you may be a redneck. One of my favorites, if your idea of taking out the trash means taking your in-laws to the Dairy Queen for supper. Which brings me to the next subject of great country western song titles. I happen to like country western music, and part of the reason is they have these great song titles. And here are some of them that I have picked up from my repertoire. I get tears in my ears from lying on my back crying over you. If the phone don't ring, baby, you'll know it's me. There's something wrong with that. You're the reason our kids are ugly. It's another one. It's one of the great songs. I wouldn't take her to a dog fight even if I knew she could win. Her teeth are stained, but her heart is pure. I fell in a pile of you and got love all over me. Oh. This is one written by a former Dallas Seminary graduate. I would have wrote you a letter, but I couldn't spell yuck. You done tore out my heart and stomped that sucker flat. That's another well-known. My wife ran off with my best friend, and I sure do miss him. They may put me in prison, but they can't keep my face from breaking out. Those are great songs. Oh, fun stuff. My goodness. Aren't you glad God made us able to laugh? It's So important. I do like getting in my pickup every once in a while and turning on Waylon Jennings. He's got a great album called The Eagle. And if you haven't gotten that one yet, you need to get that. Well, some of them are not great theological songs, understand, so don't make me responsible for everything Jennings sings, but this one is a real good one. It reminds me of my coming back where I am today. It has lyrics that say, splintered wood and rusty chain, this old front porch swing remains a pendulum of memories, swinging back and forth on a summer breeze, singing old church hymns and nursery rhymes from the days way back before my time. With a little child upon my knee, singing every sweet word back to me. Look how far I had to come to get back where I started from. With a child's wisdom passing time, singing old church hymns and nursery rhymes. I suppose coming to this place in southwest Texas is a little bit of a nostalgic experience for some of us. We come back to where we started from, if not here, geographically, places like this. I've been impressed with how many of you have come from very simple roots. I certainly have. My hometown is El Campo, and if you're ever hanging around the Gulf and go inland a little bit from Corpus or from Palacios, in that area, you get to El Campo along Highway 59. My granddaddy was a justice of the peace in El Campo, as long as I can remember. My daddy called him Judge Lundy, L.O. Lundy. He was a great man of God, taught Sunday school class at First Baptist Church in El Campo. And long as I can remember, he was probably the most well-respected man in that town. My dad was divorced when he married my mom. That was back when divorce was a scandal. And had a woman walk out of his life he had married earlier. And long and short of it is he began to sell insurance. And my grandfather in El Campo had an insurance company. Sold for Seaboard Life Insurance. Some of you folks will remember that company. And my dad left the tough memories of Raton, New Mexico, and moved down to South Texas in El Campo and met what was to become my maternal grandfather. The most significant male influence in my life was my grandfather. And my grandfather did not want him to know that he, Mr. Lundy, had daughters. The old hound dog story that Johnny started last night. In that case, this hound dog had been had that past, and yet my mother was at Baylor, a student at Baylor, and my father found out that Judge Lundy had a daughter, or had several daughters, and he fell in love with a woman named Lovell Lundy. Lovell Lucille Lundy is her name. My sister's named after my mother. She goes by Lucy. And after a courtship that was a bit of a whirlwind courtship, they fell in love and were married in 1930, right after the Depression. And had my brother in 31, who recently celebrated his 66th birthday. And had my sister a year later, who celebrated her 65th birthday. And then had me 2 years after my sister. We used to have more fun as a family. We were raised my folks called it the Great War. You know, when the World War II hit, we moved to Houston, where I was then raised. And my dad left the insurance business and went into the armament work in a machine shop. He was a little old for the draft. A very patriotic man. And so we lived in Houston, which is a city of enormous industry. And my dad returned to his original work of machinist, where they made landing gears for fighters and bombers and the rudders for the big flying fortresses, transmissions for the Sherman tanks. Some of you old enough to remember those days. The whole world of machinery retooled for the war. Remember? And I remember we drove a car that had a ration on. Remember the ration card on your car? We had an A card because my dad took five other men to work with him every day. So you get a lot, you get more gas. You get 10 gallons a week as a result of doing that. And on the back of the card, when you sat in the on the rider's side, you could read a little sign that said, "Is this trip really necessary?" Remember seeing that? Some of you look at me like I'm from Mars right now. Man, oh man. Get to be 63, you talk a lot on stuff that nobody knows anything about. And I remember sitting there as a kid because I was right at the dashboard level when I'd sit there and I'd read that. Is this trip really necessary? I'd read that to my daddy every time I'd sit in the car. I'd say, "Daddy?" He'd say, "What, son?" I'd say, "Is this trip really necessary? Is this trip?" One time he said, "Shut up! Yes! We wouldn't be taking the trip if it weren't necessary." Look how far I had to come to get back where I started from. Friends, Tom and Patsy, talk about their days at seminary. Make all of us who have been through the school remember our days. We were pre-Luke Closet and pre-pantry and pre-days like that, but we weren't before the time when God really took care of our needs. And you're just beginning a life of finding that true. Some ministries, surprisingly, may not pay well, but you wake up one morning and look on your front porch and there's a couple of bags of groceries for you. That's a neat thing. Other benefits come that are a part of a world of ministry. And you people here are the underside of the iceberg. I often think of the seminary as an iceberg. A very small part of it, the tip of it, is seen by the public and somewhat known, though not in depth, but really behind the scenes are what I call the heroes of a ministry like this. We have a body of men and women who support us, who give some absolutely anonymously. We receive gifts that come to us that we can't trace the source. Sometime we'll open a letter and it'll have in it an amount we had been praying for that would really be of great assistance to us at that time. So you never really know. We never forget our roots. We are really a simple body of men and women doing a work that God would call great. But we don't consider ourselves great. We consider ourselves as stewards, people who hold the task carefully, because this is His work. He raised it up and He sustains it. So we don't worry about it, in case you wonder. People ask, you know, about the pressure that I feel and all. I can't keep this thing going. And the man I followed couldn't keep it going. And the man he followed, well, I guess Walford could have kept it going. I know. He could run the world, you know. He could, but if in his more honest moments with you, he would say, "No, it's bigger than all of us." So, from the surface, people often look and have a misunderstanding of the kind of people we are. I don't know if you know, we have about 1,500 students. We have about 60 faculty, full-time, men and women. Women began to be admitted into Dallas Seminary in the 70s. Some of the guys didn't like that. Our first woman faculty member, Lucy Mabry, a name many of you know. I was on the board when she gave her first report after her first year as a faculty member. And it was the cutest report. She smiled and said, "Well, I'm here, even though some of the students don't think I should be here. But I've had a great year. I often will go to lunch with them and try to calm them that God could be in this." And she said, I've come a ways over these last 8 months. She said, "Matter of fact, I was voted recently the best-dressed woman teacher this year." She's the only woman teaches. So, yeah. So we have some great women. About 17% of our student body are women. They're excellent students. We have about 40 countries represented in our student body. Our students who come, and it was not an exaggeration when it was mentioned that they come, they often have children in tow and a wife standing by them and two suitcases, and that's their belongings. They come to our door and they say, "Hi," if they can say that, "we're here." And they, struggling with the language, they begin their studies in theology. It's amazing, isn't it? And often graduate very near, if not at the top of the class. And someday they'll go back to where they started from. So, you are people who assist us and believe in us and pray for us. Most important thing you can do and give to us so that we can sustain the work God's called us to do. Now, it's with all of that in mind that I turn to a simple verse in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 as we kind of take a back door to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. But first look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10. As I mentioned, people have false impressions, misunderstandings of the kind of people we are who are in leadership at the school. We're just folks. We're people who believe God. We're trying to obey Him. We have entered into what I call the sacrifice of obedience. And every time you obey, there's sacrifice involved. If in no other area than sacrificing your will for God's, sacrificing your plans for His, sacrificing His ways, your ways for His ways. Isaiah wrote it that way. My ways are not your ways. As the heavens are high above the earth, so are my ways above your ways and my thoughts above your thoughts. And that's true. Now, here's Paul, who writes the letter to the Corinthians, who had his critics. You'll notice in verse 10 of chapter 10, 2 Corinthians, he's quoting his critics. His letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Isn't that hard to believe that anyone would write that about Paul? Well, it isn't hard if you're a realist, because people can say some awfully cruel things, can't they? The paraphrase of verse 10 in Eugene Peterson's The Message reads, "His letters are brawny and potent, but in person he's a weakling and mumbles when he talks." In all honesty, I believe if the Apostle Paul were earthbound today, very few churches would even be interested in him as a pastor. He would not have good persona. He wouldn't look good on television. He probably was not handsome. In fact, I came across an old work called The Acts of Paul and Thecla by a man of Iconium, and it's interesting. It describes him as a man with a skinny, crooked legs, bushy eyebrows, and a long, protruding nose. Some believe Paul was a hunchback. He certainly had a thorn in the flesh, according to this same letter, for which he prayed three times that it would be removed, and it wasn't. Many of you know that. The word thorn means a sharp, piercing object. I rather believe it was a horrible battle with migraine, perhaps some ophthalmalia, some kind. The end of the Galatian letter, he says, "You see with what great sprawling characters I write." The idea he wrote with large Greek uncials, the large letters he wrote, probably so he could see them. Not having eyeglasses back then, he suffered with great pain. So he wasn't the kind of leader you think of when you think of a great leader. But he was a grand leader. But he was surprising in his style. I don't know if you've ever met people that you have read or or heard about and then found yourself not that impressed with their person. I remember Corrie Ten Boom and her mark in my life as she visited and attended our church toward the end of her life. Little short lady, very unimpressive looking, but just dripping with character and grace. I have known others, and you have too, who are in presence one way, but another way in their style. J. Oswald Sanders is one I've read about everything he's written, and I remember hearing him as he spoke and thinking, I think I'll just keep reading him. I don't need to hear him. He doesn't speak as well as he writes. There are people like that as well, and I don't mean that to be ugly. He doesn't come across as he does in writing. I would imagine Churchill would have been somewhat like that. I'm an avid admirer of Churchill, and about every year I read another book on Churchill, and I know much of what he's written, but I don't think I really would know him as a person. Never knew him physically. And Paul is like that. So when we get to this Thessalonian letter over in chapter 2, we shouldn't be surprised that in 1 Thessalonians 2, he describes a leadership style that is not very popular today. It wouldn't be the kind of impressive and show-stopping charisma that we often connect with public speakers. He wouldn't command an enormous honorarium, to put it in crass terms. I'm sure businesses today would not have hired Paul to travel on their behalf and to speak all over the world. Paul is a... the great thing about Paul was the character behind, the commitment, the transformation of his life. Driven to put Christians to death, he stopped in the road to Damascus. He's converted miraculously by the grace of God. His turnaround was so sudden, Christians in his day didn't want to be around him. They thought it was not authentic, inauthentic, and took Barnabas to get him into the circle of the apostles, the disciples. So here's Paul writing his first letter. Did you know? Some would believe Thessalonians is the very first piece of New Testament writing. I rather think James precedes Thessalonians, but it certainly is the first letter Paul wrote. And he identifies himself as the writer at the first line, first name. I love the way they used to write letters. They signed their name at the beginning of the letter. You wonder why we don't do that now. Because you get a long letter, and if you don't know who wrote it, what's the very first thing you do? You go all the way to the end. Oh, Frank wrote that. Okay. And then you want to read, because you read a letter knowing who wrote it, you read it differently than if you don't know who wrote it. And Paul, at the beginning of the letter, says, I'm writing this to you, along with Silas and Timothy. They were the missionaries who came first to Thessalonica. And in chapter 2, and I know I'm hurrying to it because we don't have time for the whole letter, but in chapter 2, there are some wonderful principles for leadership, wonderful guidelines that we can all follow, we who lead. And before you get too highfalutin in your definition of leadership, just understand that a leader is someone who inspires others with their influence. A leader is an inspiring, influential individual, which means, mothers, you are leaders. It means, dads, you are leaders. And the more inspiring and influential your leadership, the greater it is. My grandfather, I mentioned, was a leader in my life. Taught me to handle a boat, taught me to sail, taught me to take care of my belongings, taught me to drive. I remember driving his 1934 Ford with a rumble seat, and I ran into the garage. How I did that, I'll never know. He sat there like this, and he said, "Little Charles, you might want to move to the left a little." And just crumpled up this fender, and I thought, "Oh man, he's gonna backhand me." And he says, "Now, why don't you put it in reverse?" and let's back away from the garage. The thing's all mangled in it. I'm thinking, and he said, you know, son, he said, I can get new fenders, but I can't get new grandsons. That's a great line. I've wanted to use it instead of throwing a fit, but I usually throw a fit and then I use it. But my granddad did not throw a fit. I remember one time I got to take a nap on his bed. He had one of these, the old John Denver grandmother's feather bed. You remember that song that John Denver sang? One of these beds, you almost get a nosebleed when you get up in it. You have a ladder that climbs up. And he said, I said to him, Granddaddy, can I take a nap on your bed? And he said, well, you'll need to behave. Well, now how can you misbehave taking a nap on the bed? I said, well, okay, I'll behave. He said, I want you to lie real still. I said, okay. So I climbed up this ladder and I laid down the bed. I was absolutely at attention. I could no more go to sleep like that than the man in the moon. My granddad was right there watching me to make sure that I behaved myself, taking a nap on his bed. He's a very influential man in my life. More so than my own father was. Paul is an influential man in the lives of these Thessalonians. He came to them when they weren't looking for God, and he introduced them to the gospel. And he then calls them to remembrance. Again and again, let me show you. Verse 1, chapter 2. You yourselves know, brethren. So he's having them remember. Verse 2 of chapter 2. After we had suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know. So he's remembering. Verse 5. We never came with flattering speech, as you know. I've got those little words marked in my Bible. Verse 9, you recall. Verse 10, you are witnesses. Verse 11, just as you know. See, over and over. When you read your Bible, notice those repeated statements. They're like little links in the chain that connect the thoughts. He says, now you know when I came, so and so. You remember this happened, and you recall so and so. And as you know, I did this, and as you will remember, I did that. He's reminding them of a visit. It's a follow-up letter. About a year after he was there, maybe less, he finds himself in Corinth and he writes back to his friends in Thessalonica with a little nostalgia, with a little feeling of longing. I wish I could be back with you. Life must have been more simple in Thessalonica, or as it's known today, Thessaloniki in Greece, rather than it was in Corinth. It was simpler there. You know, brethren. Says, our coming to you, verse 1 of chapter 2, was not in vain. Isn't it a wonderful thing for us to look back on a passage in our lives that was not in vain? I look back on Fullerton in my life and I say, my coming to Fullerton was not in vain. I look back on my days in Irving and I would say my years in Irving were years not in vain. I look back on my years in New England and I think they were in vain. 2 years, two tough years. It wasn't a good fit, wasn't a good match. I left thinking I'd have New England evangelized in maybe 18 months. You don't even learn the streets in 18 months in New England. I remember I was lost, totally, and I'm in a little Volkswagen trying to find my way through the ice and snow, and I see a guy walking along the sidewalk rather briskly. This is in Newton, Massachusetts. And I pull over and I say, excuse me. He keeps walking. And I go a little further. I say, excuse me. And he stops. He says, what do you want? Which is a wonderful greeting for people who are lost. And I said, I'm lost. Well, that's obvious, was his response. And I said, you know, I just need to know how to find so-and-so and so-and-so. And I said, could you help me? And he said, I could. I said, well, would you help me? He says, yes, I will. He says, you go down two blocks, turn right, second light, turn left, and it's on your right. I said, thank you. So I took off a little further, and I said, well, let me ask you one more question. Because by now I was really hacked. I said, let me ask you one more question. Is there any reason that there aren't any street signs? And he said, we know where we are. Oh, isn't that funny? I just never did link up real well with that area. I think it was in vain. People there look back and say it wasn't who were part of that ministry, but I feel like it was. Paul said when he looks back on his ministry in Thessalonica, it was not in vain. Now, lest you think the leader has to be some kind of scintillating, unscarred, stainless steel object of perfection that kind of blows through a place. Look at Paul. He says in verse 2, after we had already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi. It's easy to pass over that, isn't it? Remember Philippi? That's where that uprising occurred, and they stripped him naked and they flogged him in the streets, he and Silas, and they threw him in jail, left him there. I mean, it's easy to say all of that in one sentence. Takes about 8 seconds. But you've never been stripped naked and flogged and thrown in jail. Nor have I, thank God. So when he got to Thessalonica, he still had the scabs from the wounds in Philippi. Ever had anybody preach to you that preached with the marks of a flogging? Me neither. Makes me sit on the edge of my seat to think about how I would listen to a man like that. Said, when we came to you, we had been mistreated already. We'd already suffered. By the way, it's great training for leadership. We've all been born in wombs of woe. You may have come from a ghetto. You may have come from a row houses in Philadelphia. You may have come from the backwoods of some back state, some pitiful, poverty-stricken region. That's fine. That's great. That's great beginning for leadership. The prophet says, don't forget the pit from which you have been dug. Isn't that good? Remember the simple places. Remember the little town. Remember the neighbors. Remember your grandparents. Remember the Sunday school teacher. Remember the one who poured herself or himself into you. He said, as you already know, we'd been mistreated. But when we got to Thessalonica, it hadn't taken away our passion. We had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition. Someone has said that following Paul through his journeys would be like following a wounded animal through the forest. Everywhere he went was a trail of blood. Misunderstood and flogged in Philippi, he escapes and gets out of town and gets to Thessalonica. And wouldn't you know it, before 2 months are over, they're already after him again. I mean, his own people saw him as a turncoat. And the Christians weren't too sure they could trust him because he had been killing Christians earlier. I mean, the guy's a no man's land. So he comes to Thessalonica, and he's carrying the message of the gospel, and he does it amid much opposition. And by the way, you may be living your life right now in the midst of opposition, and you're in good company. Read Hebrews 11, and you'll see it written. Visit the catacombs of Rome, and you'll see your forefathers. The Hebrews 11 author says, the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel, the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms and wrought righteousness and stopped the mouths of lions and quenched the violence of fire. Out of weakness were made strong. Some were sawn in two. History says Isaiah was sawn in two. Isn't that amazing? So persecuted they the prophets, so persecuted they Paul. So if you're going through a persecution, if you're being misunderstood by neighbors or people who are with you at work, if you got family members who think you're a little skewed, you've kind of gone off the deep end, you know? You got family that wonders, that's okay. That's okay. Paul had people who thought he'd lost it. I mean, even when he stood in his own defense, one of his accusers says, much learning has made you mad. And he's talking to the most significant Christian on earth, and he has the audacity to call him insane. What does he know? We had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel amidst much opposition. Believe me, when you speak amidst opposition, you got boldness. It's kind of good for you. Churchill is right. Nothing in life is so exhilarating as being shot at without result. That's a great line, isn't it? Boy, I remember standing on a free speech platform with Sweet Anderson at University of Oklahoma in 1961. They were throwing tomatoes at us. Man, it was great. I said, okay, your turn, Sweet. I'm dodging, you know, they were throwing things at us. We were at Berkeley on another occasion, a free speech platform out front. Man, they were burning parts of Berkeley. We were out there telling them about Christ. The guy right next to us was a political activist. He had a great big badge on that said, Reagan sucks. That's what this big badge said right here. And now I'm over there preaching Jesus. He was there, but don't vote for Reagan. You know, I'm over here. They got stuff flying all around. Those are exciting days, you know. Man, you know, you get out with the skin of your teeth and you look back, you go, thanks, Lord, we made it. Who knows whose lives were reached amid that opposition? Crazy times. That's good for you. What are we doing licking our wounds and worrying about a little ugly letter or a comment from somebody who doesn't know Jesus from a lizard? I mean, do we care? What do we care? That's ridiculous. Paul says, amid much opposition, we spoke the gospel to you. I love that kind of comment. So I don't have little pity parties with our students. I tell students it's tough because it's supposed to be tough. It's hard because life's hard. It isn't easy because you don't have any pride when you get a degree from an easy place. It's tough getting out of seminary because you're entering into a tough kind of world where you got to do tough kind of stuff for the Savior. So do it. Buck up. Get at it. There are hard times. So welcome to the club. He says, our exhortation does not come by way of error or impurity or by way of deceit. Now, with that, verse 3, down through verse 6, we got a list of negative things about leadership. And then 7 through 11, we got positive things. So, if you like taking notes, this is a good time to drag out your pencil and write down 4 negative qualities that you don't want to have as a part of your leadership. And then there are 4 positive qualities that he mentions in verses 7 through 11. So, having kind of set it up with these statements about his beginning ministry there, he turns to some leadership style that is very different from today. Go to the management section in the average secular bookstore and you'll see all kinds of weird titles on how to make a great name for yourself. Looking Out for Number One was a best-selling volume for years. Another one is called Winning by Intimidation. Doesn't that sound like fun? Another one was Leadership Principles of Genghis Khan. Honest. Unbelievable. How'd you like to work for a former Genghis Khan employee? That sounds like a great time. That is not great leadership. That is secular leadership. That's how to bowl them over and how to get to the top and walk on them while you're on your way up there. Forget it. That is not godly leadership. It may get you to the top. It is. It is a con job. You're exactly right. That's a good line. I'm going to write that down. That's exactly what it is. They teach you that if you intimidate, people will follow. No, they'll become disloyal. They won't work with you, they work against you because they're learning to walk over you while they're watching your principles at work. But when you serve, they never want to be away from your leadership. It's a magnificent turn of a truth here. He says, first of all, our exhortation does not come by way of error or deceit. First, negative quality. Not deceptive or from a wrong motive. The apostle says, I didn't come to you with a double-tongued message. I didn't come with a hidden agenda. I didn't have a lot of crafty cleverness in my style. I just came with my bare face hanging out, as they say in Texas. I just came as I was, and I did what I knew was right. Eisenhower, when he was president, made this comment. In order to be a leader, one must have followers, and to have followers, one must have their confidence. Hence, the supreme quality for a leader is unquestionably integrity. If I were to name the number one quality necessary in a godly leader, it would be integrity. Integrity. You keep your word. You fulfill your promise. You admit it when you're wrong. You give the other person the credit when that person is due the credit. you fulfilled your calling for the glory of God as a person of absolute honesty. You return your phone calls. Or you confess to the person when you finally get around to it, you forgot. That's integrity. That's coming not from error or from impurity or from deceit. That is so old, it's new. You never go wrong with integrity. Second negative quality, not a people pleaser. That's verse 4. Just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, who examines our hearts. For we never came with flattering speech, as you know. He is not a people pleaser. When you try to please people, you lose respect. You don't gain it. You have to make decisions that are unpopular. And they are impossible for everybody to understand, and they will not all agree with you. But when your desire is to please God, at least the pressure is not as great. My friend Clyde Cook, who's the president of Biola University, has a little sign on his desk. When you visit him, you always see that little sign. It says, "I don't know the secret of success, but I do know the secret of failure. Try to please everybody." If you're a people pleaser, you're a poor leader. Or you're not as good a leader as you could be. If you're a people pleaser, you're lacking a spine that those who follow your leadership expect you to have. Sometimes you have to say the hard thing. I was going through a tough time in a former church, and I won't name which one. They had a sacred cow out of an offering box, and we came to a place where we realized we need to start passing the plate instead of having the money given in a little offering box in the back of the church. And I was on the board, and I had the swing vote on the board. We had 6 guys, and I was number 7. The board was absolutely divided, 3 on one side and 3 on another. And they said, "Well, Pastor?" And I said, "Well, give me a night to think this over." Because I knew whichever way we'd go, we'd have major trouble on the other side. And I told Cynthia, "I'm going to go spend some time with Floyd Sharp, who was a pharmaceutical salesman, spent that evening up in Sherman, Texas." So I left, and I went up, driving up there, and I was driving my little Volkswagen. And I propped my Bible up on my steering wheel. Driving is clearly one of the most boring experiences of all life. And so I do a lot of reading as I drive. I do a lot of changing lanes also as I drive. And so I'm reading Galatians, and I say, "Well, I know Paul had a tough time with the Galatians, and I know that with the whole subject there." I thought, maybe I can find some help there. So I get to verse 10 of chapter 1. I remember it like it was yesterday, and I found my answer. Look at Galatians 1:10. 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Galatians. There it is. "Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Or am I striving to please men? If I were still trying to please men..." Notice Paul was once a people pleaser. See the word "still"? "If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a servant of Christ." People pleasers are not real servants of Christ. They're slaves of people. I'm going to say that again. People pleasers are not really servants of Christ. They're slaves of people. And it's easy to be that in the pastorate because you want people to like you. I mean, it's not fun to be in the pastorate with most of the people not liking you. So you try to be diplomatic. You try to say, "Oh, isn't that a darling baby?" When, you know, in your heart, you should just say, "Isn't that a baby?" You know, things like that. Now that I'm my age, I don't say "darling." I say, "Oh, isn't that an interesting child?" Something like that. Isn't that a baby? "If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ." That's it. And I turned right around. I pulled over. Cars came by, and I let them stop. And then I turned around and went right back to our home. Went right back. I found the answer. And I voted. And boy, you know, all hell broke loose. Hey, I'm sorry. I got to vote my conscience. I'm not here to make the elders happy. I'm here to vote what I really believe. I'm not there to be abrasive either. Understand, don't go crazy with this one. But if you really follow Christ, you've got to make decisions that everybody won't like, especially those you vote against. And they'll misjudge you, and they'll see you as harsh, and they'll see you as uncaring, and all those things are said. That's all part of leading. Now back to 1 Thessalonians 1. We never came with flattering speech. Isn't it a hassle to be around a flatterer? The glad handing everybody and making sure they tell everybody what they want to hear. That's horrible. Why do we want that in a leader? And Paul says, I didn't do that. When I got to Thessalonica and I saw some things that were wrong, I said, you know what? That's wrong. I said, you know what? That's going to hurt you if you keep doing that. And I told this person that I was talking to on the corner, you know, you're lost. You're lost without Christ. You're just lost. I can help you find your way, but I will never tell you that things are going to be okay if you continue in that journey. You continue in that journey, you're bound for hell. People respect folks who tell them the truth. That's why I'm convinced Billy Graham is one of the most respected people today. He will not tell you it's okay if you don't believe in Jesus. And Paul didn't either. So, you're making a list. He was not deceptive. He was not a people pleaser. Verse 5, he was not greedy. We never came with flattering speech, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. That's so good. Those of us in ministry have to be careful about greed. We have to be careful about every time we get with the rich, we don't bring up money. And every time we're around those who could buy the lunch, we don't expect them to buy it. We pick up the tab. I had lunch with a billionaire, multiple billionaire, the other day. One of the few times in my life, if I had before, I didn't know it. This time I knew it. And I deliberately picked up the lunch tab. I thought he was going to faint. He said, oh, no. And I said, no, let me get this. And I'm not telling you that to make me look good. I'm just saying he expected to pick it up because he always picks up the tab because he's rich. It's easy in our work of needing money to get greedy with people and to think, well, you know, they won't know. Rich people are smart people. They know when you're sniffing around. They can tell. They can tell when your heart's right. Paul says, I was with the rich. I was with those who weren't rich. I wasn't in it for the money. I tell our guys at seminary, don't ever do a wedding for the honorarium. About halfway through my ministry in Fullerton, I finally got the picture. Stop taking honorariums for funerals. Now, that's my own personal conviction. I just don't feel right taking money for burying people. It's already expensive enough for people. If I love these folks, what am I doing taking $100 for dropping them in the ground? You know, they're having to dump a lot of that in the mortuary. My work's free at that point. And I had to watch my greed. It's hard to do when you don't have much, you know. And I just say to you folks, watch out for greed in the pastorate. And people will try to bribe you with their money. You probably heard the story of the pastor who went to this church and it began to fill up, and before long they needed a new worship center and it wasn't going to cost them $1 million. And a couple of reprobate brothers were in the church. They were rich skunks and they were living the life of a hypocrite. And one of them died, and his other brother came to this pastor and he says, hey, I want you to preach my brother's funeral. And he said, and I want you to do me a favor. I want you to tell everybody he was a saint. And here's $1 million for the new building. Pastor said, fine, I will. Took the money, deposited it. Remember that part of the story. Funeral came, and a box was here full of this body of the reprobate and his brother sitting out there ready for the big line. And he said, I want everybody here to know this man was an unbelieving reprobate. He wasn't faithful to his wife. He wasn't caring about his children. He was a hypocrite at church. He ripped off many people in his profession. But compared to his brother, he was a saint. Watch out for greed. Here's another one. Number 6, verse 6, number 4 for your list. He was not authoritarianistic. Autocratic is an easier word. We didn't seek glory from men, either from you or others. Even though as apostles of Christ, we might have thrown our weight around. We might have asserted our authority. That's good, isn't it? We didn't seek glory from men. He wasn't a glory hog. He didn't seek glory from others. You or other people, as apostles, we could have asserted our authority, but we didn't. Ministers can assert their authority. People with PhDs can throw those words around. Folks on faculty at the seminary can kind of strut their stuff. We have no business doing that. We're not here to impress people at TBRM. We're here to serve. Those who graduate from our school and get a hard-earned degree and graduate even at the top of their class have no right to assert their authority and take advantage of people. We who serve, serve. Now, there are moments when, of course, our convictions require us to stand alone. But it's not to bully people and to push folks around and take advantage of those who don't know the original language. I was in a church where a pastor misused the original language, and he abused the congregation with his knowledge of theology. And people just sat there and drank it in, and not realizing that it was heresy. But he threw the Greek and Hebrew at them all the time. That's asserting authority that's not fair. I mean, you go to your doctor and then he starts talking in Latin? Your doctor doesn't do that. He could. He writes stuff in Latin. You go, what is that? His handwriting already looks like Latin. And then he writes this prescription and he does it in Latin. And he could really take advantage of you. I love the words of Elton Trueblood in a book called Your Other Vocation. Listen to this quote. It is hard to think of any job in which the moral element is lacking. The skill of the dentist is wholly irrelevant if he is unprincipled and irresponsible. There is little in that case to keep him from withdrawing teeth unnecessarily because the patient is in a helpless situation. It is easy to see the harm that can be done by an unprincipled lawyer. Indeed, such a person is far more dangerous if he is skilled than if he is unskilled. Isn't that true? Getting a degree from the seminary makes you dangerous if you abuse with it. It need not, and it wasn't with Paul. Now, so much more I could say on that, but it's not necessary. Look at the positive side. Are you ready for this good list? The balanced side of the leader. Some things to include in your leadership, verses 7 through 11. First is sensitivity to needs, verse 7. You're going to love this about Paul. We prove to be gentle among you. Isn't that a great word? Love the word gentle. As I get older, I like it more. That's what Dr. Pentecost was when he dropped to his knees and hemmed the pants of this seminary student. Here is this brilliant doctor of theology, hemming pants for a seminary student. Sorry, that melts me. We prove to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her children. Oh, that's great. Milligan says this is language from the nursery. Language from the nursery. You ever watched a mother in the early morning hours with her nursing baby? Our younger daughter lived with us when they had their second child. Her husband's an intern at our church, and so I would come down the steps early morning hearing a little rustling downstairs about 2:30 or 3 o'clock, and I knew it was Colleen. One time I came very quietly down the steps, and I leaned down on the floor was up here, and so you get halfway down the steps before you could see downstairs, and I looked around, knowing this chair she was sitting in, nursing her baby, and I looked around like this, and here she was with that little lamp on. Tears in her eyes, she was exhausted, holding that little baby to her breast, gently nursing him. gentle as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her child. Sensitivity to needs is a very important part of good leadership. When we had our first child, I had never held my own baby, of course. That was our first baby, little Kurt, little curly-headed Kurt. Every hair was curly. If you pulled out one hair, it would go. And it would just be like a little sheep. You could pull it out and go. It was just as curly. To this day, it's just tight little curls. And I remember picking up Kurt from the little crib, and his head fell back. And I said, hold your head up. You know, it was about 2 days old. And Cynthia says, honey, you got to put your hand under his head. I didn't know that. They don't have kids laying there. And I finally get my hand under his head, and I hold it up, and I just put him on my shoulder, and he cries. He hits his gums on my collarbone right here, you know. She says, you've got to be gentle with him. Remember how many times your wife told you that? You've got to be gentle. You've got to be gentle. Yeah, I was ready to throw a football with him. Here, catch, you know. little tiny baby, bone still soft, little hole in his head up here, you know. You can feel the pulse. That's the picture here. And look at the next one. If you think that's gentle, look at verse 8. Not only sensitivity to needs, but affection for people. Having thus a fond affection for you. Fond affection. This is the great Apostle Paul with fond affection. Yes. Yes. Get it clear. We had a fond affection for you, for we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel, but our only lives. Why? Because you became dear to us. Isn't that great? We're on the side of the Apollo, you know, he's a battleship. Boom! And cannons going off, and Barnabas, little rowboat, picking up the people that he's knocking off. And that's not the Apostle Paul. He's gentle. He's caring. He's got a fond affection. These people are dear to him. That's Paul. Get it straight. We've got the wrong idea of Paul. This guy had been beaten to the end of his life. You're not proud when you've been beaten. You're humbled. You're broken. You care. This is a good leader. It's a good leader who weeps when the people weep, who feels for them. You became dear to us, a fond affection. Verse 9, you recall our labor, brothers, our hardship, how working night and day so as not to be a burden. Remember, he wasn't greedy. Verse 5, so we're not surprised that he made tents. He worked night and day so as not to be a burden to any of you as we proclaim to you the gospel of God. What a model, a wonderful model. Affection for people, sensitivity to needs. Here's authenticity of life. That's a third one. You're witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave toward you believers. You know that. It's an authentic life. And finally, verse 11. Just as you know how we were exhorting and encouraging and imploring you as a father would his own children. This is enthusiastic affirmation. There's the fourth. Enthusiastic affirmation. Do you notice something? As a mother, verse 7. As a father, verse 11. It's like bookends. As a mother, as a father. And what does a father do? Why, he affirms enthusiastically. You ever sat near the father of the quarterback on a high school football team? It's unbelievable. Okay, Frank, you can do it. You can do it. Call play 6485 red. Go for it. You know, you're sitting there. This father's back there. He's got this dialogue with this son. When we were in high school, we were in high school stadium for 17 years. Our kids were slow learners. No, they were stair step. You know, they all went. So they played ball. They were cheerleaders. And so we were in a high school stadium forever. And one of those years, one of our best friends, Dan Coelho, his son, was a quarterback for our high school football team. Dan changed that year. I mean, he's shouting plays out, and the kid's trying his best to fight, you know, and when they'd sack him, he'd, no, that line, you've got to block. for that book. You know, this kid, okay, Dan, all right. You know, what's he's affirming his kid. One time his kid looks back out in the stand and says, be quiet! And he goes back to it was great. His kid's hearing his dad yelling all the way through. He's affirming him. He's standing with him. Johnny's got a kid that plays ball. He plays for the Bulldogs. And Johnny's one of the coaches for this little team. Now, I have a feeling Johnny's not on the sideline going, that's interesting. Nice play. I mean, he's all over the place. He's affirming him. He's pulling for him. He's yelling with him. That's a dad's job. That's what the leader does. In your own personality and in your own way, you affirm people. You say thank you. You get to know them. You touch their lives. You tell them how great a job they're doing. When they're not, you get them alone and you affirm them so that they can do a better job. You correct the course. You're the guy, you're the gal that's pulling them on. It's like a mother with her kids and dad with kids. That's our role. Wonderful balance. Did you get the feeling here of the velvet and the steel? Do you see it? As a mother, tenderly, as fond affection, you became dear. That's the velvet, and you see the steel come out. You know, we exhorted and encouraged and implored you as a father. Why? So that you would walk in a manner worthy of God who calls you into His kingdom and glory. Because we see the goal in view. The leader never loses sight of the goal. We're moving in the right direction. Hooray! It's coming together. That's our job as leaders. It was the 150th anniversary of the birthday of Abraham Lincoln that the distinguished poet Carl Sandburg spoke before a joint session of Congress. The year was 1959 and the month and date February 12. He addressed the person of Lincoln in his speech, calling him man of steel and velvet. Listen to his words and I close with them. Not often in the story of mankind does one arrive on earth who is both steel and velvet, hard as rock, yet soft as drifting fog, who holds in his heart and mind the paradox of terrible storm and peace unspeakable. While the winds of war howled, he insisted that the Mississippi was one river meant to belong to one country. That railroad connections from coast to coast must be pushed through. While the war wavered and broke and came again as generals failed and campaigns were lost, he held enough forces of the North together to raise new armies and supply them until generals were found who made war as victorious war has always been made, with terror, frightfulness, destruction, valor, and sacrifice past words of man to tell. Get this. In the mixed shame and blame of the immense wrongs of two clashing civilizations, often with nothing to say, he said nothing. He slept not at all, and on occasions was seen to weep in a way that made weeping appropriate, decent, and majestic. Lord, in the midst of our learning and growing and maturing, in the hardships of life that could embitter us, in the reading of critical mail that could devastate us, in the disappointments of people who let us down and fail, it's easy for us to push to another extreme, to get a little mean, or even become manipulative with our skills. What a marvelous model you've left for us in this man, Paul. Not perfect by any means, but committed to Christ. Thank you, Father, in advance for good that will come from a talk like this, for people whose lives will be touched deeply in the home, in the workplace, in their relationships with others. Help us to become like this model you've left in the scriptures, a person of velvet and steal. Full of compassion, mixed with great, strong, and unbending convictions. People of integrity who still know how to weep and laugh and care and cheer. We commit this time to you and these moments now that follow in the dear name of Jesus Christ, who was the perfect model of all of these things. We pray. Everybody said, Amen. Amen.